All right, welcome. Thank you for attending session 222, the Marshall Family and the One Drop Rule. Like all the other sessions, this session is being recorded and audio will be available for purchase at the Sunstone Audio Desk after the session. And we are competing with next door, the Ask a Sex Therapist, so let's keep our energy up too. It was alleged that the grandmother of a family in Fillmore, Utah, who had joined the LDS Church in rural Alabama in 1896 and had come to Utah in 1905, had Black African ancestry. Though her grandchildren showed no African American characteristics, the males were denied priesthood ordination, and the family was denied access to temple rituals. The history of this family's plight included intercessions by Marion G. Romney in 1944, David O. McKay in 1957, and Spencer W. Kimball in 1977. Robert Bob Greenwell has a bachelor's in history from Weber State University, a master's in history from the University of Utah, and is a doctoral candidate in history at Ohio State University. He was a DAAD research fellow for the Federal Republic of Germany. So we'll turn the time over to Bob.
I'm going to be talking about these, quite a bit about these three individuals right here. So I'll just kind of introduce them to begin with. This is Isham Bonifor, who was born in Lowndes County, Alabama, which is an area by Montgomery, Alabama, in 1834, and he died in 1904. This is his daughter, and her name was Dorcas Leanna Falk Milgate, and she was born in 1872 in Crenshaw County, Alabama.
Will you say it in the microphone since it's
Yeah, important. And she died in 1938. And this is her daughter, who is Gussie Milgate Marshall, who was born in 1907 and passed away in 1990. The inspiration for this study came from an address by Dr. Gregory A. Prince entitled Lowell Benyon, David O. McKay, Race and Priesthood, delivered at the 2014 Sterling McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture entitled The LDS Intellectual Traditions, A Study in Three Lives, held on April 12, 2014 at the Catherine Tanner Irish Building on the campus of the University of Utah. While Dr. Prince was delivering his lecture, I began hearing names of people I had known for some time, although I had never heard their names mentioned in connection with race and the priesthood, and I had decided to investigate the matter in detail. This investigation led to my study of the one-drop rule, or the rule of hypodescent, as it applied to a devout Mormon family in the town of Fillmore, Utah in the 20th century. At the outset of this presentation, I need to make it clear that I do not believe a deity places the curse of a dark skin on his children and denies them priesthood ordination because of alleged trespasses. I do, however, believe that such a curse and priesthood denial could and did come from white men who thought they were following such a deity. No other topic in LDS teachings led to more discussion in the 20th century than the church's position regarding Black African priesthood denial. Most American churches have been tainted with racist thinking at one time or another, but most of them, even in the South, had abandoned such thinking by 1960. Key Mormon leaders, however, continued to entertain beliefs in white racial superiority and Black moral and racial inferiority into the late 1970s and even beyond. Much has been written on LDS Black priesthood denial and all of its aspects. This study concentrates on one aspect of the discussion, the so-called one-drop rule. Also called the one black ancestor rule, the traceable amount rule, or the rule of hypodescent, the one-drop rule posits that racially mixed persons are assigned the status of the subordinate group, even if they show none of the characteristics of the group to which they are assigned. To be considered black in the United States, one only needs to have a known black African ancestor, no matter how remote. Within the LDS Church, the one drop of black African blood denied a Mormon male of all rights to priesthood ordination and his family of access to the most important temple rituals, which are thought to be essential to exaltation in the afterlife. Belief in this principle led to a serious amount of frustration, hardship, heartache, and even a severe racial identity disorder in an otherwise devout Mormon family in the small rural town of Fillmore, Utah. The saga begins not in Utah, but in the rural deep south state of Alabama. In Crenshaw County, an area near Montgomery, Alabama, in 1872, a daughter was born to Hannah Falk and Isham Bodeford. Hannah Falk was a mulatto woman who was given a wide path because she mixed potions, practiced folk medicine, practiced folk religion, was thought to be capable of casting spells on people, and was considered by her neighbors to be in possession of supernatural powers. Such women were actually common among blacks in the 19th century South, and they were known as root doctors or Negro doctors. They were nearly always women. Hannah Falk was the product of a relationship between her white mother, Nancy Falk, and an unknown black man, most likely a slave. Isham Bodeford was a prominent farmer and Civil War veteran. He had been a Unionist when the Civil War was declared, which was very unusual in the Deep South. He hid out in the woods to avoid service in the Confederacy, was captured after being chased by slave dogs, joined the Confederate Army, and fought in some of the most important Civil War battles, including Shiloh, Resaca, and Atlanta. Isham was also a true Southern gentleman in that he was a busy boy who fathered several children with at least three different mulatto women. The daughter born to Hannah Falk and Isham Bodeford was given the name Dorcas Leanna Falk, Dorcas being the name of a New Testament woman thought to have been raised from the dead by the Apostle Peter, as described in the book of Acts. All of the available federal censuses from Crenshaw County list Dorcas Falk as being a mulatto, which meant she was assigned to black status. Mormon elders first appeared in Crenshaw County in the late 1880s, and although they were met with hostility and threats, a thriving Mormon community was established in that part of Alabama by the mid-1890s. Isham Bodeford was the main benefactor of the Mormon community in the county. Meetings were held on the Bodeford Old Field, either out of doors when weather permitted, or in a large frame building on the property. The Bodeford farm became the center of missionary activity in that part of the South, and Uncle Isham, as he was known to the missionaries, provided meals and lodgings hundreds of times for the elders. Conferences with as many as 200 in attendance were held on the Bodeford farm in Lapine, Alabama. "Our mission is not to the Negroes," the missionaries were instructed by the legendary president of the Southern States Mission, J. Colden Kimball. "We are not to visit nor preach to them. Those who seek for the gospel we shall teach, but them only." Dorcas Leanna Falk sought out the missionaries with the assistance of her father, Isham Bodeford, and she was baptized and confirmed on May 26, 1896. Sometime after October 1904, Dorcas Leanna Falk migrated to Utah with other members of the Botaford family. There were actually already members of the Botaford family living in Hatton in Millard County, including Sarah Jane Botaford, who married a Claiborne White and moved to Mesa, Arizona, where they became prominent members of the Mormon community. Their grandson was Wilford Whizzer White, a member of the Arizona State University Hall of Fame, and his son is Danny White, the former quarterback and punter for the Dallas Cowboys of the National Football League. Dorcas settled in Fillmore, Utah, and on December 2nd, 1905, she married Jesse Milgate. The marriage took place in Fillmore in spite of an 1888 Utah law which forbade mixed-race marriages. Jesse Milgate was a prominent member of the Fillmore community. He was a brickmaker and mason. He owned a lime kiln in Chalk Creek Canyon. He was a plasterer or council miner, and he was also the town sexton. Sextons in early Utah prepared graves for burial and cared for the cemeteries. Jesse had been a widower for over 20 years when he married Dorcas Falk, who came to be known as Dorcas in Fillmore. Three children were born to Dorcas and Jesse Milgate. Gussie Milgate was born in 1907. Another daughter, Jessie, was born in 1909, and a son, Jeremiah, came along in 1910. These were happy years for the Milgate family and only ended when the family patriarch passed away in 1922. Mormon racism became a growing problem for the Milgates after the death of Jesse. The United States was an extremely racist society in the first half of the 20th century, and the Mormon Church, as well as most other churches, was a racist institution. Mormon racism was based on a lineage myth. There were thought to be chosen or royal lineages and lineages that were thought to be inferior and cursed. Mormon leaders and scholars promoted the idea that because of their valiant and heroic efforts in a war in heaven during a premortal spiritual life, they had entered mortality as a chosen people to further God's work on earth and to preserve, administer, and exalt the ordinances of the priesthood. They thought that they had entered mortality or the second estate through the lineage of Joseph's son Ephraim and were thus, along with the Jews, God's covenant people. Blacks, on the other hand, were said to be inferior because of a divine curse that God had placed on the entire lineage of Adam's son Cain, the so-called Mark of Cain doctrine. Cain's descendants inherited a black skin which survived the great flood through Egyptus, who was thought to be a descendant of Cain, and her husband Noah's son Ham. This couple's son Canaan continued the curse, and his progeny were banned from receiving the priesthood and were further condemned to be servant of servants. The inferior status of blacks is said to be based on their behavior during the premortal life in the spirit world. Just as there were noble and great spirits in the preexistence, there were also less valiant, cowardly, and indifferent spirits. Those who entered life cursed with a black covering emblematical of eternal darkness, to use the words of Joseph Fielding Smith. These less valiant and morally inferior individuals were barred from receiving the Mormon priesthood and could also not participate in the most sacred temple rituals. Individuals with any known black African ancestry, no matter how remote, were subject to these restrictions, the so-called one-drop rule, even if there were no outward signs of black African ancestry. Those of the chosen lineage were also cautioned to never intermarry with the seed of Cain. If the white man who belongs to the chosen seed mixes his blood with the seed of Cain, Brigham Young warned in a speech in 1863, the penalty under the law of God is death on the spot. This will always be so. This racial ideology was given a scriptural proof text with interpretations of various passages in the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham in the Pearl of Great Price, which was canonized in 1880. It should be noted that for many centuries, people in the West have assumed that the human family started out white. Anthropologists, however, have determined that anatomically modern humans first evolved in East Africa, from there spread to West Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and on to Australia and Europe, and relatively recently across the land bridge known as Beringia to North and South America, and most recently to Oceania, including Hawaii, Tonga, Samoa, and New Zealand. Anatomically modern humans were initially black, and whiteness is a later adaptation. Everyone thus has a black ancestor. Thus, as the Millgate children sought to raise their family, there was in place a priesthood ban for those thought to have the blood of Cain, based on first presidency precedent, interpretations of Mormon scripture, and a culture supportive of Mormon attitudes towards African Americans in the priesthood. A temple ban extended to all blacks of African descent. The 1920s and 1930s were difficult years for Dorcas Millgate and her family. She was a single mother forced to raise a young family under difficult circumstances. The family was known for its hard work and for its faithfulness to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. When Dorcas died from cancer in 1938, she was described as having been a most ambitious and hardworking woman, honest and upright, a faithful tithe-payer, and a most faithful member of the church, who was always willing to do her share and more. At the same time, the family lived a partially shunned existence because of its known racial heritage. Dorcas was described as a quiet stranger in our midst, and her life as having known toil and care and bitter loneliness. Dorcas' two daughters, Gussie and Jessie, married and raised families in Fillmore, although rumors of blackness in the family made marriage difficult for them. Her son Jeremiah, or Jerry, was drafted into the Army during World War II and was wounded in the Battle of the Bulge in 1944. Gussie, the eldest daughter, married a Frank Marshall in Juab County in 1931, although Frank spent a great deal of time living away from Fillmore and the family. Four children were born to Frank and Gussie Marshall. Frank Marshall Jr., who was known as Junior, Eldon DeRoy Marshall, Jesse Ross Marshall, and a daughter, Joyce Marshall. Because Dorcas was known to be a person of color, and Gussie exhibited slight black characteristics, problems arose for the family when the boys reached priesthood age. They were denied priesthood ordination by the local ecclesiastical authorities in keeping with LDS church policy. The boys were seated in a row behind the deacons when the sacrament was being passed during the church service as a way of making them feel they were part of the ritual, although they could not actually take an active part. Since they did not look any different from the other boys their age and had no contact whatsoever with blacks and black culture, they could not understand why they too could not be ordained to the priesthood. Because of church policy, the church officials could not help Gussie with her predicament, and so she consulted with Elder Marion G. Romney, who was at the time an assistant to the Council of the Twelve Apostles and was attending the Millard State Conference on June 4, 1944, on behalf of the Church Welfare Department. During this meeting in Fillmore, Gussie Marshall explained her problem and apparently admitted to Elder Romney that there had been a black progenitor in the family, but the color line had run out since none of her children exhibited signs of black African heritage. Upon returning to Salt Lake City, Elder Romney consulted with two members of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, Elder Joseph F. Merrill, who Gordon B. Hinckley described as having a compassionate heart beneath a brusque exterior, and Elder Albert E. Bowen, a former lawyer. These three men determined the Marshall boys were ineligible for priesthood ordination because of their slight black African lineage as determined by the one-drop rule. In a letter dated June 16, 1944, sent to Gussie Marshall, Elder Romney wrote that his heart is touched with the tragic problems you face, but male members of the church who have a trace of Negro blood in their veins, though they themselves show apparently no signs of it, may not receive the priesthood. He went on to write that this answer will continue to stand as it does until another ruling is made. He further stated, life has trials which cannot be understood, but someday a merciful God will make known the reasons for all of our sorrows. Romney concluded by saying he hoped the Lord will give you wisdom sufficient for your needs, that you may be able to keep your boys true and faithful to the standards and principles of the gospel, even though they cannot now understand why they are not permitted to hold the priesthood. Gussie must have been completely heartbroken at the news of this decision. She was, however, a strong woman and remained active and steadfast in her belief in the Mormon Church in spite of this major setback. Her oldest son, Frank Marshall Jr., however, became estranged from the church because of the priesthood denial, and he spent most of his adult life living near Pensacola, Florida, where he was a member of the Herald Assembly of God Church. As the Marshall children grew older, it became apparent they possessed considerable talents and abilities, especially in the field of athletics. Junior was a good baseball player, a boxer, and a talented football player, being for a time the quarterback on the Dixie Junior College football team. Jesse Ross Marshall was a star track runner, a decent football player, and he was a good student as well. Joyce Marshall, the lone daughter, was attractive, had a strong, sparkling personality, was elected cheerleader in high school multiple years, was selected a rodeo queen attendant, played the clarinet well, and was well-liked by everyone. Some in Fillmore even doubted the racial lineage rumors about the Marshall family because Joyce was so pretty, vivacious, talented, and possessed blonde hair. When she attended college at Utah State, she became a cheerleader and a member of the school's marching band, although she withdrew from school when other girls shunned her because of rumors of black lineage. Exceeding them all in physical talent, however, was the middle child, Eldon D. Roy Marshall. Eldon excelled in track, especially the sprints, was a starter on the basketball team, was a star pitcher and center fielder in baseball, and above all, was an outstanding football player. In his senior year, Eldon led Miller Tide to the state Class B football championship, and he was selected first-team All-State halfback. He was even given his own honor assembly on February 8, 1951. On this occasion, Mr. Hack Miller, sports editor of the Deseret News, presented him with the first Tom McCann Bronze Football Trophy in recognition of his selection as the most outstanding high school football player during the 1950 football season. At the same honor assembly, Mr. Otto Wisely presented Eldon with an award as the most outstanding junior American Legion baseball player during the 1950 summer season. Eldon was awarded a football scholarship to the University of Utah, and he played on the team during the 1951, 1952, and 1956 seasons, although he never achieved the same stardom in college that he achieved at Millard High School. Eldon Marshall enrolled at the University of Utah in the fall of 1951 on a football scholarship, and at the same time he took courses and attended services at the LDS Institute of Religion, which had been established and was directed by Dr. Lowell L. Binion. Dr. Binion was a noted scholar who had studied in Europe, a humanitarian, and a friend of students at the university, and the two men met in a very emotional way. Following Sunday school one day, Eldon went to Dr. Binion and with tears in his eyes told how he was asked to pass the sacrament but had to decline because he did not hold the priesthood. When asked why he did not hold the priesthood, Eldon explained how it was believed in his hometown of Fillmore that his grandmother had come from the South and was believed to be tainted with black African blood. Dr. Binion was flabbergasted to hear this, since Eldon had blue eyes and blonde hair. Dr. Binion was not a believer in the LDS Church's racial teachings and priesthood ban. He thought the ideas had first been enunciated at a time when no one questioned their authenticity, and then a dubious theological structure based on false premises had been constructed to bolster them. He also categorically rejected the notion that alleged behavior in a premortal life led to a curse in earthly existence. Dr. Binion made his views known to a few insiders, including President David O. McKay, but later felt he had not been vocal enough and had compromised my integrity in not standing up and shouting it from the housetops. Dr. Binion was also aware that such ideas caused serious problems in individual and family lives, as was the case with Eldon Marshall and his family. Lowell Binion and Eldon Marshall developed a close personal relationship after the emotional encounter. Eldon was often invited to the Binion household for dinner, and he played football with the Binion children on the lawn. Eldon was injured during the 1952 football season. He dropped out of school, enlisted in the Army for 2 years, and upon returning to Salt Lake City, worked at ZCMI and Kennecott Copper Corporation. Suddenly, one day, the same student Lowell Binion had known years earlier appeared in his office with another perplexing problem. Eldon's younger sister, Joyce, whom Dr. Binion had met years earlier, wanted to be married in the Salt Lake Temple, but she was unable to get temple clearance from her local ecclesiastical authorities. Eldon, in the meantime, had spoken with Apostles Marquis Peterson and Joseph Fielding Smith, both of whom he had come to know while employed at the ZCI Men's Department, where most general authorities clothed themselves, and they had taken the matter up with the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. The bride and groom-to-be were interviewed extensively by members of the 12, but matters were not proceeding well because of Marion G. Romney's previous discussions and correspondence with Gussie Marshall concerning priesthood ordination for her sons. Elder Romney was now a member of the Quorum of the 12. He discussed the letter he had sent to Mrs. Marshall in 1944 with other members of the 12, and this stalled movement toward the temple marriage being allowed to proceed. The wedding was scheduled for Friday, June 14th, 1957, and it was already Tuesday, June 11th. Eldon telephoned Dr. Binion and told him he had given up hope for a positive outcome. But the ever-optimistic Lowell replied, "Let me see what I can do." Beginning in 1935, just after becoming the founding director of the Institute of Religion at the University of Utah, Dr. Binion developed a close personal relationship with David O. McKay, who in 1951 became the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Binion telephoned his friend Hubie Brown, and he set up an appointment for the Institute director to meet with President McKay on Wednesday morning, June 12, 1957. Upon meeting with President McKay, Lowell Binion explained the Marshall wedding situation to the church president. He appealed to his sense of justice, mercy, and fairness by stating, "President McKay, in my experience, the gospel builds life. Here I see it tearing it apart, tearing it down." President McKay responded to Binion's plea for help, and although it was getting to be almost too late to do anything, said, "Leave it to me." David O. McKay then proceeded to contact a number of people familiar with the Marshall family just one day before the scheduled wedding. Since Marion G. Romney already knew there was black lineage in the family, he would have been a likely candidate to halt the wedding, but he did not want to be the one standing in the way of eternal bliss. "I should be perfectly happy," Romney told President McKay, "to approve your decision." McKay next spoke with Archer C. Brown, the former president of the Millard stake. When asked about the possibility of colored blood in the family, Brown replied, "There has always been an understanding that it was there." When asked if he had known the grandmother, Dorcas Falk Milgate, President Brown, who had offered the closing prayer at her funeral in 1938, stated, "She certainly looked like there was Negro blood there." McKay then asked Dr. Binion if Eldon Marshall had any black characteristics, and he replied, "No, he said he had talked with a geneticist, and he had said there was no evidence, but there is no evidence of color in the family." In spite of the strong evidence of a black color line in the Marshall family, McKay next telephoned Paul Anderson, the anxious fiancé, and told him, "I do not see how you can make it, but I think we shall let you go through the temple." That same evening, McKay telephoned Roy Open, the Fillmore stake president, and authorized him and Bishop Lloyd Mitchell to issue a temple recommend for Joyce Marshall. Since there was no hard evidence of black lineage in the family, it was only rumor-based. Upon learning of President McKay's decision to allow the temple wedding to take place, President Open declared, "We haven't better people than the Marshall family in the ward." Although President McKay based his decision to allow the wedding to take place on the proposition that it was only rumor-based, he probably knew there was black lineage in the Marshall family based on the testimonies of Arthur C. Brown and Marion G. Romney. Since, however, none of the Marshall children exhibited evidence of a black color line, he allowed the temple wedding to take place because it was a humane and proper thing to do. After this time, people familiar with the wedding circumstances believed President McKay knew of the likelihood of black lineage in the family, but allowed the wedding to take place in spite of this. It was thought President McKay removed the curse of Cain from the family. The Anderson-Marshall wedding was a whirlwind affair. The temple recommend was signed on the evening of June 13th, and the couple got up early the next morning and drove to Salt Lake City for the wedding, a distance of 150 miles. After the wedding ceremony, the entire entourage drove all the way back to Fillmore for the reception hosted by Gusty Marshall. "Popular young couple united in marriage," read the headline in the local newspaper. There was a large attendance at the reception, and the gift room was filled to capacity with gifts. The dream of a temple wedding was fulfilled, and Gussie Marshall's lifelong dream to go through the temple came to pass. Other radical changes occurred in the Fillmore Third Ward following the wedding. On Sunday, June 23, 1957, Jesse Ross Marshall and his cousin Leonard Royal Thornton were ordained and sustained as priests, and J. Ralph Thornton became a teacher. A week later, Eldon Marshall was ordained a priest, and a few months later, he was ordained an elder by Lowell L. Binion. A short time later, Eldon was called to serve a mission in the Northern States Mission, where he labored in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Nebraska from 1957 through 1959. President McKay's decision to allow the wedding to take place thus bore immediate results, and it produced positive long-term results as well. Eldon would later serve a mission in Kentucky with his wife. Ross Marshall spent many years as a seminary and institute instructor in various locations in the Intermountain West. Jay Thornton would serve a mission in the Gulf States Mission and would spend 20 years as an accountant for the LDS Church. Paul and Joyce Anderson would occupy a host of leadership positions in the church in Utah and California. And they would preside over the Melbourne, Australia mission from 1995 to 1998. President McKay's decision to bypass rumor and hate in favor of building lives rather than tearing them apart proved to be the wise and correct decision, as Lowell Bunyan suggested it would. Jesse Ross Marshall had an outstanding academic career. He received a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from BYU, and he joined the church education system. He taught seminary in Moreland, Idaho, and was a seminary principal as well. He later moved to Missoula, Montana, and became an institute instructor at the University of Montana while simultaneously acting as coordinator of early morning seminaries in northern Montana. From 1969 to 1982, Ross was employed as a high school principal in Sunburst, Montana, Colville, Utah, and Salina, Utah. At the same time, he served a number of leadership positions in the LDS Church, including Bishop of the Wanship Ward in Summit County, Utah. Although members of his family never complained about rumors of Black African ancestry, even though they bothered them a lot, Ross developed a seething resentment toward the people of Fillmore. It became such an obsession that he eventually wrote a book cataloging injustices imposed upon the Marshall family by many of the people of Fillmore with their constant flow of gossip concerning Black African ancestry in the family. Eventually, the obsession became so overwhelming that Ross contacted Elder Marion D. Hanks, whom he had met while being employed in the church education system. And Elder Hanks arranged a meeting between Ross and the First Presidency, including church president Spencer W. Kimball. The meeting took place in the church office building on April 13, 1977. Was a rather lengthy affair in which Ross vented his numerous complaints against the people of Fillmore for their rumor-mongering and concluded with President Kimball and the other members of the First Presidency giving Ross Marshall a blessing through the laying on of hands. Overcome by the anguish expressed by Jesse Ross Marshall, President Kimball, accompanied by his second counselor, Marion G. Romney, made the decision to drive to Fillmore in order to participate in the Fillmore, Utah State Conference on April 17, 1977, in order to resolve a problem of a brother, Ross Marshall, that has been troubling him for a number of years. When it was announced that President Kimball would be attending the state conference, an overflow crowd was waiting at the steakhouse to welcome him. The first speaker was Ross Marshall, and he told how he had lived his life with the rumor of Black African lineage that had supposedly been cleared up by David O. McKay in 1957. He told how he had hatred in his heart toward the people of Fillmore, had written a book of 400 pages in which he had chastised those who had spread rumors, would destroy the book before its publication, and ask the people of Fillmore to forgive him, that this great burden be lifted from him. President Kimball followed as a second speaker. He said that a few people had been persecuting the Marshall family over Black African lineage, and after this day, not a word will ever be heard or spoken concerning this matter. And if it is, it shall be squelched immediately. He went on to say the matter should be buried forever, and if anyone ever hears this matter discussed, they should be told it is not true. President Romney then cautioned everyone to always speak the truth and be careful to comply with the instructions of the president of the church, and he bore his testimony that President Kimball is a living mouthpiece of the Lord. State President Lloyd P. George concluded by stating, "We have heard the word of the Lord, and we vow that we will take heed to the council and we will kill this rumor that has gone forth from this area." Those attending the conference left with the feeling that they would be endangering their eternal salvation and even their current church membership if these rumors persisted. Most people in Fillmore are reluctant even today to discuss the matter. In spite of President Kimball's unscheduled visit to the Fillmore, Utah State Conference in 1977, and the call for a halt to rumors concerning black African ancestry in the Marshall family. Problems did not end there. Many in Fillmore resented the fact that Ross Marshall had brought so much attention to the community, and he was never popular in the town after that. In addition to this, there's the problem of racial identity disorder in the Marshall family. This condition arises when one identifies with a particular group but is in turn not completely accepted by this group. Perhaps the most famous example of this disorder is the famous actress and singer Lena Horne. Lena was raised in a black household, was raised in a black neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, and identified with blacks and black culture. She was nevertheless not completely accepted by many blacks because she was extremely light in color, sang mostly in white venues, and was married to a white musician. This caused her immense emotional problems during her early career, but she was later able to overcome these emotional disturbances. The members of the Marshall family were affected in a similar fashion. They identified with white Mormon culture and had no connection whatever with blacks and African-American culture, but were nevertheless not completely accepted by the group with which they identified completely. This led to a serious problem, a problem like you would never know, one family member told me, for members of the Marshall family. Junior Marshall became deeply embittered toward the Mormon church and withdrew completely from the Mormon community. He found spiritual comfort in the Assembly of God denomination. Eldon Marshall expressed deep sorrow to Lowell Bunyan at not being eligible for priesthood ordination, and he even consulted a geneticist in order to be sure of his racial identity. Joyce Marshall Anderson suffered traumatic ostracism as a college student, and she was always haunted by rumors of black ancestry wherever she lived. Rumors of the curse of Cain were a constant source of heartache for her. It was Ross Marshall, however, who suffered most deeply and tragically from racial identity disorder. He became a marginal man. He failed to find peace within himself even after a prophet's blessing. His marriage floundered and ended in separation and divorce, and he was eventually driven to commit suicide in 1997. Mormon racial teachings were thus not merely abstract, harmless exercises in theological gymnastics, but had real-life negative and tragic consequences as well. Spencer W. Kimball, who had been greatly concerned with the LDS Church's racial policies and the priesthood and temple bans for many years, began in the spring of 1978 an earnest attempt to come to grips with changing these policies. After weeks of intense fasting, pleading, and prayer aimed at lifting the priesthood and temple restrictions on blacks of African descent, President Kimball on Thursday, June 1st, 1978, received confirmation to reverse church policies that had been in place since 1852. This most dramatic moment of the Kimball administration and highlight of church history in the 20th century has been canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants under the title Official Declaration 2. Although the revelation on the priesthood had immediate and far-reaching repercussions for the Mormon church, it was nevertheless an incomplete measure in that it failed to address the broader question of Mormon racial ideology that had been so important to every church leader since the administration of Brigham Young. It was not until Dr. Randy Bott, a popular professor of religion at Brigham Young University, expressed ideas of a curse of Cain, black lack of valor in premortal life, and the lack of readiness to receive the priesthood on the part of blacks to a Washington Post reporter in 2012, the year Willard Mitt Romney was seeking the presidency of the United States, that the LDS Church officially announced it had abandoned earlier racist thinking on the part of church leaders. On December 6, 2013, the church issued Racing the Priesthood on its official website, in which it was declared that the church disavows theories advanced in the past that black skin is a sign of divine dishonor or curse, or that it reflects unrighteous actions in a premortal life, that mixed race marriages are a sin, or that blacks or people of any other race or ethnicity are inferior to anyone else. The Mormon Church had now reinvented itself regarding its problematical racist past position, and it went a step further on August 13, 2017, when it issued the statement that white supremacist attitudes are morally wrong and sinful, and condemned church members who promote or pursue a white culture or white supremacy agenda, and declared they are not in harmony with the teachings of the church. Amen. Amen.
Thank you so much for that. It's a great, great presentation. I'm wondering if you know, since you've been involved in this conversation, what is the official policy or what is happening in regarding to the missionaries that go out throughout the world on this subject? What are they taught to teach to investigators regarding this?
Well, you know, from the 19th century on, they were instructed not to teach blacks, not to initiate any discussions with blacks, but now it's encouraged. You know, the church is trying to become a universal church, and so there's really no restrictions.
Okay, so that's sort of my second question is, so given that, do we know what the official teaching is when missionaries are out and they meet African-American people? Do they raise this history?
Try to avoid talking about it and bringing it up, and many of them, after they become members, don't find out about it until later on. And it's a real problem for the church in the United States, not so much in Africa, but in the United States, it's a real problem because, you know, African Americans get baptized, and then a few months later, they find out that all of these racial ideas were so prominent in the church, and they have a real problem with inactivity after that.
Just as an aside, I did some volunteer work in Uganda a couple of years ago, and through the course of that ran into a couple of local members, and it wasn't my intention to raise the subject, but eventually kind of got in that direction, and it was very, very clear that none of them had any idea.
Yeah, they're not taught that, and it's a real problem when they find out about it later on. In fact, members of the Genesis group spend a lot of their time trying to counsel people who find out about these things later on.
So, I served my mission in Brazil 20 years ago, and I've got some friends who served right around the time where the priesthood ban was lifted. So I was wondering if you could sort of, I really appreciate you telling the story about these people who were affected by the priesthood ban, and I'd like to know, this is more of a personal question for you, what your disposition was when the revelation was given, how that affected you, and sort of what motivated you to tell this story?
I actually, to be honest with you, because of the racial teachings of the Mormon Church, I gave up on the Mormon Church a long time ago. So, I thought that the priesthood declaration in 1978 was far too less and far too late. That was my feelings about the whole thing.
The,
My wife is from Fillmore, so I knew these people. And when I heard, I'd never heard anything about the black African ancestry in the family. In fact, I met Gussie Marshall on a few occasions, and I thought she had a Pacific Islander background. I had no idea that it was actually black African ancestry. And then when I heard Dr. Prince give his presentation at the conference at the University of Utah in 2014, I started hearing these things, and I decided that since I knew many of these people, I knew Paul and Joyce Anderson quite well, they're kind of indirectly related to my wife, I decided to investigate the whole thing and see if I could come to grips with finding out about the entire story. And this led to this this study that I did on the one drop rule and how it affected the Marshall family.
In your studies, have you come across other families of similar stories?
Yes. There actually is another family in Millard County. There's been very little research done on them. But it turns out that it's a family from that originally came from Tennessee, and it's an incredible story. It's a story about a slave owner who actually ended up marrying one of his slaves and moving to Utah, and their family had a lot of problems with priesthood ordination and that sort of thing. It turned out with them, some of them were allowed to have the priesthood. Around the turn of the end of the 19th century and the first part of the 20th century, they were allowing some to be baptized if they didn't show any signs of black African ancestry. And some people in this particular family were ordained to the priesthood, but others weren't. It depended on how they looked.
As a teenager in Southern California in the, 1958 time period, the word went around in our stake that there was a family in Los Angeles that had this problem, that the family had come from the South and had no idea of their ancestry or anything, and they converted to Mormonism and got all involved and excited about doing genealogy work. And in doing that, found out that back several generations, quite a few back, great-great-great-grandma was a mulatto from a slave family. And so the story went around in the stake that this teenage boy was stripped of his priesthood when the family found this through genealogy, and all the teenagers were just aghast that this, realizing what socially this would do to this teenage boy to suddenly be set aside and ostracized like this in the Mormon community. But I never heard any names, and I assume the whole family dropped out of the church at that point, so there may not be a record of being able to recover the story of the family, but it's a similar kind of problem. We have a similar kind of problem in the Tanner family, which is still not fully resolved, but Gerald's great-grandma was a convert from England, and the question was whether she had some trace of black in her. And so Gerald's grandpa's generation, the grandpa's name is Caleb, and there was another brother who was called Cain.
That was nice of him to give him that name.
And so the Gerald's sister grew up with, the older sister grew up with this horror of fear that possibly there was black blood in the Tanner family. Yeah. And she just prayed and prayed that her boys would be able to pass, and no one would figure this out, and the boys went on and got priesthood and married in the temple. But for those that were worried about this, this was socially such a horrific prospect.
You know, it's a disorder. It's a racial identity disorder. Yeah. Racial identity disorder is not recognized by the American Psychological Association and their what they call DMS-5. But there's been a lot of attempts to have it included, and so far they haven't. But you know, maybe they will before long. And by the way, after the Civil War, the Mormon Church, the LDS Church, concentrated a lot on sending missionaries to the South, and I'm sure there were a lot of cases like this. A lot of these people ended up settling in Colorado, and I bet if people really looked into their ancestry, I bet they'd come up with it. It's only been recently that they've actually released the censuses, so you can actually look back in the censuses in the 19th century in this Crenshaw County in Alabama to find out how they were how these families were listed. Isham Bodeford created a lot of problems for African Americans to do their genealogy, since he had more mixed race children than he did white children by a long ways. And in looking through some of the genealogy, you find a lot of African Americans that are trying to determine who their father was, and a lot of them have ended up with Mr. Isham Bodeford. In Brazil, they also had a lot of problems with people getting ordained to the priesthood and then later on finding out that they were actually mixed race. This is one of the reasons that led to the 1978 declaration, because of all the problems it was creating in Brazil.
Quick question, but first I was going to make a comment to the question that was previously asked. I served my mission in St. Louis, Missouri, and East St. Louis, Illinois, actually. So for a year of my life, I was the only white person I mostly saw. And this was the beginning of my confrontation with God about what leaders had taught me, and so this subject is very personal to me in that way, and it was the first time I had revelation that went against what other revelation had been given as far as the church goes. But I just want to say that there's absolutely no direction given to missionaries as to what to teach. I was one of those missionaries fumbling with, I never gave an excuse, but I'll never forget the moment where I said to someone, it was wrong. And that is racist, and God is not a respecter of race in that way. And I felt so empowered. And being an MTC instructor later and working on curriculum that teachers have to teach other missionaries, I tried to vocalize that, but nothing has ever been discussed. So my admonition to now missionaries is to read the church essays and at least start there, even though that's, But I do have a question for you about the book. Sorry, about the book that was destroyed. Is there any remnants of that? Is there any memory of that?
The book still exists.
Okay. So
I was told by a family member, but he wouldn't tell me who has it, or I wasn't able to look at it. I'd really like to get a hold of it. I actually think that he's the one that's in possession of it, but he... He wouldn't give me any details on where it was, or I asked him. I said, "Boy, I'd like to look at that." He says, "Well, it's not available."
Yeah, told me.
But there have been a handful of family members that have read it, and it's it'd be interesting to read this. By the way, in Brazil, they had special lesson plans, teachings for families. They would ask them to. If they had pictures of family members or that sort of thing, so they could determine, if there was any race mixing or anything up until they finally decided that it was such a problem that they needed a revelation to remedy the situation.
Real quick.
Okay. It's more of a statement. I just find it ironic that
because of the doctrine of baptism for the dead, the church created these great genealogical records where people would never have known if they hadn't have had access to the church's gathering of these records, and also now that Ancestry.com, which was, I believe, started by LDS members for genealogical research, now with their DNA database program, people are finding out through that that many of their ancestors were from various parts of the country. So a church problem and excavated by the church.
You know, it became such a problem, especially in Brazil, that they finally had to have a solution.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Bob. Yes. Remember, the next session started at 11:30. And as you feel those sickening stirrings of injustice and prejudice, it's our hope that we can channel that into a way to be upstanders, to advocate for the marginalized, and to always keep compassion at the core of our hearts. So thank you so much.
I'm sorry that the photographs didn't stay up, because you could plainly see that Dorcas was actually a woman of color.
Yeah. You know.